Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to The Incomplete Skeptic, Sober Wise Guy. The drill for The Incomplete Skeptic is generally to unmarginalize marginalized voices. Everyone's voice deserves to be heard. Everyone has a voice, and we can all work on changing the world, or at least our world. So I welcome you to The Incomplete Skeptic. And now we're doing the Sober Wise Guy series. In today's day and age, it's important to bestow our voice for loved ones online, in my opinion. No one lives forever, so when they yearn to feel the spirit of their loved one, I interview old timers. So, you know, we're going to be gone someday, and people will be able to tune in and hear our voice someday. And we might even help a newcomer or someone that's looking for an intelligence on what it means to be sober. And I generally interview people that are 30 years or more clean and sober, to some extent in recovery. And from what I've noticed is that old timers are sometimes marginalized. People assume that they don't need positive reinforcement, or they just have big egos and should be summarily dismissed as less important than newcomers in recovery. I don't believe that. I think newcomers are the lifeblood, the body. Old timers are the backbone, and God is the spirit of recovery and has all power and animates both body and mind and soul of recovery of the system we call the 12-step program. The objective of the Sober Wise Guy is to share experience, strength, and hope to the still suffering addict or alcoholic, and to inform the public about what the recovered life looks like and why bother being sober. My guest today is Deb H. Thank you, Deb, for being a guest on The Incomplete Skeptic, Sober Wise Guy.
Appreciate that.
I have a quick question for you before I get into the nuts and bolts of your recovery. What would you consider the greatest compliment anyone could ever give you?
That I live authentically.
Amen. So what is your sober date?
My sober date is February 16th, 1986.
Oh my, so you just had a recovery date, and that's how many years?
37.
37, okay. I went to a public school in this country, so I might have got that number wrong.
I had to refigure that myself, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have to reevaluate every year at this point, you know. So what discipline are you sober in? I don't mean like the name of the program per se, unless you want to say. Is it alcohol, drugs?
Alcoholism.
Me too. So let's get into what you were like before you sobered up.
Okay.
What did that look like in your life?
Okay. Well, I was, I'm a twin. I have a twin brother, and we have a very large family. The twinning thing actually comes in to play an important role. It's a male, and he's right-handed, I'm left-handed, and we don't look anything alike, or I would be one ugly man, or he'd be one ugly woman. So I have seven brothers and two sisters, and I come from a profoundly abusive background and criminally neglective environment. And so the most of us kids raised one another. And so when the parents couldn't be there, the brothers and sisters were. There was physical, mental, sexual, and verbal abuse in the household. And I have to say that I never felt safe there my whole life. Not one moment, until I left home. So that kind of sets the picture. I had my first drink when I was 13 years old at a wedding. And I was a very fearful individual, fearful child. But I did very well at school. I mean, at school was my life. And alcohol made me feel like I finally fit in, that I only had two glasses of champagne. And that's really significant because I never had one drink. I felt wonderful. I felt like I fit in. I felt like I was pretty. I felt like I could do anything. And so that kind of started me on my road of 13. I started smoking when I was 12. My best friend died in front of me. And that's really when I started drinking. I just couldn't cope anymore with everything else that was going on. I was born.
How did your best friend die?
She was accidentally shot by her younger sister in front of me with a gun. So I lived in a suburb where I was born, and then we moved up into a rural area when I was 12 years old. And so at 13, she was the first person that was my friend there when I moved there. And her family were big hunters, but they never locked up their guns. And their dad was an alcoholic, and their mom, you know, was doing the best she could. And her little sister just said, "Do you want to see what I got for my birthday?" And I said, "Sure." And she pulled out the gun. She broke it down, you know, like she knew gun safety. She broke it down to make sure there wasn't a bullet in there. And she snapped it up and it went off and it hit Elaine. Oh, I shouldn't say her name, but it hit her. And she bled to death internally within probably 15 minutes. Are you there?
I am. I muted my mic just so you wouldn't have to hear any background noise.
Okay. So anyway, after that, I started drinking after that wedding and after my friend's death, I started drinking as much as I could and whenever I could. Now I was only 13, so I couldn't go to the store and buy it. So I would sneak it. I would have my connections, and that's what I would know was known for, is I could get people to buy alcohol for me. At that time, I was very cute, and I could manipulate guys pretty easy, and they would buy me the alcohol, and then I would share it with my friends. And my drinking frequency got more and more common. And by this time I was dabbling a little bit into marijuana, but I never liked that. I kind of got sick from it. And so my true drug of choice was alcohol. And I graduated high school and I moved to another suburb. My parents kicked me out of the house. They said, "You have 3 days to leave," after I graduated. So I left and went to New York to help my sister with her kids. And I did not like that. And I came back and I got a job waitressing until I could earn enough money to go back to the city that I was born in, where my twin brother was at the time. And so I think I was 18 and a half, maybe not even that old. Yeah, I was pretty young and immature. But I had taken a nursing class for certified nursing aid. And so I got a job in a hospital in Illinois. And it was December. And I'm going to tell you the story about how I met my spouse, because it's significant. I was doing, I didn't make a whole lot of money. So in order for me not to have to pay rent, my twin had asked me, he said, "Okay, you do the laundry and you do the cooking and I will cover the rent." And I said, "That's fair enough." And so I was at the laundromat and some guy held the door open for me. And I said, "Thank you." And I smiled at him. And that's when he remembers me. And then the next time I was standing over a washer and I looked up and there was a person about 25 feet away from me, and he had a white aura all around his head. And I said, "Oh my God, I'm going to marry that man." And so I went back to the laundromat with clean or dirty clothing for 4 months until I met him. And he asked me out to a home show 4 days later, and we've never been apart since. And so we just celebrated 42 years of marriage. It'll be 43 in August. And I was pregnant when we got married. But it didn't matter because I knew I had 4 months to think about this. And so when I when I actually did get to meet him, I asked him every question in the book. Do you beat women? Do you drink? Do you do drugs? What's your background like? And he passed, and I'm sure he was like, what the heck? I'm sure I'm just wondering why he didn't run away crazy, but he didn't, he stayed around me. So anyway, from there, my drinking progressed. I was 19 when I got married and 19 when I had my first child. And Tom, my husband, had started noticing my drinking, and he said he didn't want to have just a sex relationship, alcohol and sex relationship. And so I said, fine, then we'll only have sex on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I'll only drink on Fridays, you know, being a smart ass. Mm-hmm. And but it planted a seed that it wasn't okay to drink in front of him as much as I wanted to, and to behave in a way that was not becoming. And so he was in the military, and we lived in the Great Lakes area for a couple years after we got married. And then I became pregnant with my second child, and with both pregnancies, I did stop drinking. But I went crazy. I was nuts. And with my first one, I had postpartum blues, and I didn't have any way of coping. And so it took me a long time to work all of that through. And I didn't know, I just didn't know. I thought there was something wrong with me. I mean, there was something wrong with me, but I thought I was defective and nobody else had the same thing. So we moved over to Adak, Alaska, which is about 2,000 miles from Anchorage, I think, out on a tiny little island that had a ton of earthquakes a day. Wow. No trees, snow, rocks, eagles. Very interesting place to live, but I drank a lot. And that's where I crossed over. I had my second baby by then. And so I was 19 when I had my first son and 21 when I had my second son. And when we were up on the rock, as they called it, I think I was 23 when we moved up there. And that's where my drinking crossed the line, where I could not stop. I couldn't stop on my own. And during that time, my little brother had gotten into a really bad accident in a part of Alaska, and he was electrocuted. And so I flew there. It took me 2 days to get there, but I flew there to, he was taken down to Seattle, and my mom and my brother Bruce were there. And my brother Bruce, he and I got along like oil and water. He's about like a year older than me. and he had changed. He was different. And I said, what's up with you? And he said, oh, he said, I found AA. He said, I don't drink anymore. I've got 6 months sober. I was like, oh. I said, really, how are you doing that? You know? And he goes, oh, we use the big book, and I go to meetings. And I was like, a big book, you mean like the Bible? Cause this, by this time I was looking for answers. So I had gotten into the Bible, and there's nothing worse than a drinking fearful Bible thumper. Anyway, it's terrible. And he goes, no, not the Bible. It's called the big book. And I was like, oh, so it doesn't mean anything. And so he turned like beet red. He was just so mad. And we had this relationship where he would get really mad at me. He would take my arm and stick it up behind my back until I gave in. And then all was fine. And he calmed down, and he goes, I'm sorry. I really got mad at you. I really apologize. And I thought my head was going to spin around, because this was just not Bruce. I mean, I was truly impressed. And I said, oh my God, what is this? Hmm. How are you doing this? And so he told me a little bit, and I said, well, if you've got a drinking problem, where does that leave me? Because we all drank the same way. And he goes, well, I can't tell you if you have a drinking problem, but here's what they told me is, just have two drinks a day. And if you can control that two drinks a day, then you're probably not an alcoholic. And of course, you know, the first night or two, I had two drinks just and behaved myself. And then the third night, of course, not. And then I got into a big fight with my mother, and I don't call her mother now, but I mean, I got in a big fight with her, Lorraine, and I questioned her about why she had left me with abusive people when she knew that they were sexually abusive people. She knew it because I told her. And she started crying. And of course, then it was all my fault for bringing that up. But it was the first point in time where I'd started taking my power back, really, and holding people accountable who had mistreated me. So Bruce played an important role in my sobriety, mostly because every single time I drank, I wondered why I was drinking. He really ruined my drinking. And anyway, we left the Rock and we ended up back here in Minnesota. And I started trying to figure out what was going on. So I went to Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I went to Al-Anon. And I thought, you know, I am an adult child. I learned a lot of great things there. I learned some really fabulous things in Al-Anon, and that was as far as it went. And I was continuing to drink. My husband was overseas. And so he came back and we were to move to Germany. And I was just right before my 25th birthday, we moved to Germany. And then he was called away on a very special assignment. And I was left there with two little kids and no furniture, nothing, in Germany, where I didn't speak the language and I didn't know what was going on. And then all of a sudden I heard ding dong. And I said, it was like a flat. So I said, yes, who is it? And he goes, beer man. And I was like, oh my God, there is a God. So they deliver beer door to door, just like milkmen do. And so he brought up a case of beer and he brought up a case of wine. And I was happy again. I was happy that I had this. And within a very short period of time, all the beer was gone and almost all the wine was gone. And I thought, who drank all that? And of course, there's nobody else around but me, and the boys certainly weren't. And so I decided I would go back to Al-Anon because they could fix me. That would be better. And I found an Al-Anon meeting across the Autobahn in this church. And so I went there and they said, oh, the Al-Anon meeting isn't going anymore. This was on a Saturday. And so this guy, everybody had a nickname, and he said, my name is Dick with a stick, because he walked with a cane. And he said, let's just go in the other room because I'm a double winner. Ha ha ha. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so crazy. And he just kept talking about himself over and over and over. And I said, finally, I said, I'm kind of tired of talking about you. Can I ask you three questions? And he said, yeah. And I said, I truly, honestly don't remember the first question, but I said, if I keep reliving the past over and over again, does that mean I have a problem drinking with alcohol? And he goes, well, I can't tell you if you have a problem with alcohol. That's something that you're going to have to decide. And I said, if I just keep living in the past over and over, reliving all of these terrible things that have happened to me, does that mean I'm an alcoholic? And he said, I can't tell you that, Deb. You're going to have to come to an AA meeting and discover that for yourself. So he said, I'll tell you what, why don't you come on next Tuesday? There's an AA meeting here, and we can, you know, we'll help you out. And I said, okay. So my husband was still away on this assignment, and I had two bottles of wine left. And so on Monday, I took one, I poured a glass, and I poured that bottle out, and then hurried up and poured out the second bottle before I thought about it, and had a drink out of a crystal wine glass. I remember picking out the glass specifically, saying, drank it. And I said, there now, I've only had one drink. And that's the only time I've ever had one drink in all my life. And so that next day, I was going through the shakes already. I was very tiny. My gut was really big though. My liver was being affected, and my legs were super skinny. And that day I had a lot of shakes, and I don't know if I was shaking from alcohol or shaking from nerves, but I knew I was going to go to this meeting. So I got somebody to watch the kids, and then I walked down the street and up across the bridge, and right over the bridge, I could not take another step. Honestly, I couldn't take another step. And I saw the church, you know, cause it was like, I don't know, it wasn't very far from the Autobahn. And, I just said, please, I need help. And all of a sudden I was at the door of the back church. I don't know how I got there. It was like magic. I walked in and they said, oh, who are you? And I said, well, I'm Deb. And then they introduced themselves, like Rhinemind Bill, Dick the Stick, la, 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 all these different names. And the room was blue with smoke. You know, you could smoke when you, by then. and I fit right in there. And they were like, "Hey, Bill, where'd you get him?" "I don't know, Dick. What do you know about her?" And I felt like goods, but at the same time, it was kind of sweet. And they were a bunch of old men. There were no women in there. And they said their names. When the meeting started, they said their names. They said they were an alcoholic. And I knew that you had to say you were an alcoholic or they were going to kick me out. And I really didn't have another place to go. I didn't know what else I could do. So they said, "Well, welcome and keep coming back." And nobody had ever asked me back. And they said, "Here's the key to the church. You come back next Tuesday. You're going to make the coffee and clean out the ashtrays." And I said, "Okay." And so I got my 12-step work right there. I felt like, you know, I felt like I was 25 and they entrusted me. And so I just kept going back, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since then. And a couple of things that they told me, they said that when you want to have a drink, when you think about having that drink, we want you to think it through. We want you to follow that. Close your eyes. Think about that first drink. Think about the second drink and the third drink, or however many you're going to drink, and what happens to you. And every single time I drank, my head ended up in the toilet. My kids were neglected. I felt terrible the next morning. And by noon, I was already convinced that I could try it a different way. So that was my MO every single night. And then they said that we will happily, we'll give this program 6 weeks. And in that 6 weeks, if your life has not greatly improved, we will happily refund your misery. And my mind Bill goes, "And I'll buy it for you." And I just, thought that was the corniest thing, but it was actually okay. I don't have anything to lose. I have 6 weeks and I want to see what happens. And, you know, at that first meeting, all they did was, you know, like smoke cigarettes and get really, really nervous. And I couldn't bring a cup of coffee up to my mouth without shaking it all over. So they only filled it halfway. And I was really in a bad shape, you know. And then the other thing too, is that every time I drank, I had flashbacks and PTSD and I was suicidal. So I didn't really know if I was going to try and commit suicide when I was drinking that night, or, I couldn't tell. Anyway. I went back the following Tuesday. I was still shaky, but not as, and then, pretty soon I had 4 weeks of not drinking, and I wasn't puking anymore. And I didn't have the bed spins anymore. I could drink a whole cup of coffee without spilling it all over myself. I was making myself giving my kids breakfast. And then I got my sponsor. I got my very first sponsor. Her name was Monica, and she was very elegant. She wore mink and she had long nails and she had long, beautiful black hair. She was like, "Well, you need to shower. You need to shower daily and you need to brush your teeth." And so I learned how to take care of myself. I didn't know how. You need to eat. So I started eating. She helped me a whole lot. She told me I was one of the most selfish people that she had ever met, self-centered, selfish. And that crushed me, but it was true. I mean, all I could think about was me. And then she taught me about the 12 steps. She taught me about doing 12-step work and what that meant. And I took as many commitments as I could. Of course, there was only one English speaking meeting when I sobered up. And then about 6 months later, another one started. And that was very helpful. So I got to go to two meetings a week. I used the grapevine. I did a lot of my step work, especially my amends step. I used...
sorry to interrupt, but probably a lot of people might not know what the grapevine is.
Oh, the grapevine is a monthly written, like almost like a mini meeting that tells people about, you know, you can read about people's story in there. And it's just like a little, I don't know, maybe 20 pages, but it's usually packed with a ton of information on what to do and what situation. I used to just pore over that thing about looking for my thing. Like, I just didn't know how to handle my kids. And so I would find a story about a parent who was in early sobriety and what they did. I did the same thing with Living Sober. Living Sober is another book, AA approved literature. that is all about living sober. And so I would just pour through those things about like, ooh, anger, I'm scared, you know, and or fear, oh my God, or I want to drink, what am I going to do? And I phone call, well, I called my sponsor every day, but the difference between phoning my sponsor and telling her what was really going on and learning what to do in given situations. I mean, I would have been on the phone with her all the time because I did not know. I didn't know how to do these things. I knew that I loved my children. I just didn't know how to love them. So I was about 6 months sober when my husband finally came home off of assignment and we had received our shipment of, I don't know, like we got like 2,000 pounds worth of furniture or dishes or all that kind of stuff. And I had unpacked everything. And so it was a home. And I told him that I was going to try not to drink anymore. And he didn't think too much about it. He just said, okay, no, all right. If you really think that's what you want to do, okay. And that's just how he is. He's really a very supportive individual. Then we moved from Germany to California, and California was amazing. California was like truly a kid in a candy store with just thousands of meetings around me on a daily basis. Wow, hundreds. And so I got to go wherever I wanted to go for meetings. And I went into a form of treatment for child sexual abuse recovery, where you, it was called Parents United. And it was this group that they had not only perpetrators, but victims of child sexual abuse. And it really helped me see how sick these individuals were, and that it wasn't me. And if it hadn't been me, it would have been somebody else, because that's how sick they are. And it doesn't mean that I was over it by any way, shape, or form, but that was the first step in healing in that area. And then from there, I just continued to grow. I went to parenting classes. I read everything I could get a hold of. I would ask people, is this normal in this situation? I went on and off birth, even now, to therapists, just to figure out what time of my life am I, and how do I manage this? Because I just don't know. And I mean, anything that kind of scares me, I just go into shock. And so I have to be really careful who I'm around, and I have to be careful with what I say and how I treat myself, because I can go back to that poor little kid, that little six-year-old that, you know, that, I mean, I can just go back to her in a heartbeat. And so I incorporate her into my daily life today. So we live in California.
I'm actually, sorry to interrupt, but I'm actually glad you said that, because I think it's, you know, people think we're supposed to get over things or something, you know, and, you know, it's like, I've known you for a long time, you know, transparency. And I remember some of the things that you've said here, you've said before. I'm getting more insight now than what I'd gotten in the past. But, you know, I've been in Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and people would say to people in MAD, get over it. It's like, what, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years since you lost your loved one, and you're still sitting here whining about it. It's like, get over it. People would literally say that. And I just don't think they understand that everyone has their own timeline for grief. And, you know, and I think it takes a miracle of God to give us another chance, like opening our eyes to where we can see the white aura around someone else, or somebody being planted in our lives at just the right time, like it's divine appointments. And I feel like that's what happened with you and I in my early sobriety. You were saying things that actually addressed a lot of the stuff that I'd been through. And I didn't have any judgment from you, and I just didn't hear any of that stuff, you know, and that was really important, to just have good boundaries, but yet be authentic and transparent, reasonably transparent, you know, and it's a habit that I've tried to carry into my life as well. So I just thought I'd kind of throw that out there. I, you know, when I think of my early sobriety, there's a number of people that really touched my heart, and you were one of the few, and it was really important to me, you know, in my healing journey to recognize God was involved in my hearing you in a way that made sense. You know, I didn't see a white aura, but I sensed something was there that was very God-centered, you know. So anyway, sorry about interrupting and redirecting a little bit here. But there, I think there's people out there that just need to know that it's okay to not be over something per se, you know.
And you know, I mean, no matter how many times I've tried, and I mean I've tried for a long, long time to put it behind me and to do this and to just grow up, just do this or just do that or just stop it. And it has never helped. And in fact, it just kind of makes matters worse. And so I just accept her. I accept her that sometimes she's driving the bus and I have to gently pull over and say, no, you're not going to drive it this time. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. So one of the things that has really helped me a lot with processing my feelings and my thoughts and my emotions, because I get stuck in them, is painting. And these are some of them right behind me. So, and I didn't know that I could
paint.
Oh,
those are yours. Okay.
Yep. You're mine.
So, do you have a website
that
you would care to share? Okay.
I don't have a website for that.
Okay.
But each of these paintings represent something. They are emotionally based. I am an emotional impressionist. And so I get upset and I go to the easel and I paint. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful outlet. For many years, it was smoking. For many years, it was running and running races. For many years, it was eating. And now it's painting and quilting. So anything in that creative touch that I can do to get the feelings out on something so it's not turned in on me, the better off everybody is, including myself. And so anyway, we moved from California. I learned a whole lot in California. We were in the big earthquake. We were there, so that's a while back. And then we came here to Minnesota. So I've been in Minnesota since 1990. We bought a house. Tom was still overseas. And then he retired out of the military in 92. So then he was finally home. And I said, my boys were 12 and 10. And I said, here you go. They have had so much estrogen. They need your testosterone. And that's about the time that I actually, I think I met you then, Timothy.
Yeah, I sobered up in 90. So
Yeah. And so I met a whole wonderful group of people. Many of them, I don't even know if they're around anymore. That really helped me out while Tom was overseas. That last 16 months was so hard when he was gone overseas. It was just very, very difficult. And I had a whole community of people who supported me mentally. And for you military wives out there that are out there now, there's so much more help available for people who are trying to make it all happen with the spouse being overseas. Or so, you know, email me or something and I'll tell you some of the resources.
One of my best friends was stationed in Hamburg, and his wife, and at the time he was a practicing alcoholic. So I'll probably pass this on to him. He gave me my 2-year medallion, and I think I met you. I had a little bit of stability in my life. So I'm guessing I was probably sober a year and a half, maybe a year.
Yeah. You know, were in rough shape though, still.
I was, the first 18 months was just a nightmare. I was nuts.
Yeah, you know, you were having a really hard time. And I recognized that right away. And that was okay. I mean, that we don't come here because we're whole beings. I mean, we're human mm-hmm. beings, but we're not whole beings.
Yeah.
And we all grow at different rates. And so there's some people who are spiritually way ahead of me and some people who are not, who, so, I mean, we just all have different assets and things that we can share with each other. I think that's what's so wonderful about going to meetings is I hear what I need. I mean, I get and hear what I need, and everybody else says that they get and hear what they need too. So it's like this great, solid, spiritual circle.
Mm-hmm.
And when one person is up, another person is down, and when the other one is down, then the other one's up. So, what else? What do I want to say? So, I started painting. I walked away from a career during COVID because I didn't like the way I was being treated. And I went into a business that's kind of cutthroat. And the first company that I worked for was great. And then I moved with the promise of everything being better, and it wasn't. And in October of last year, I walked away from that job. I was like, nope, this is not for me. And I wasn't getting enough sleep. I wasn't able to make my meetings. And I was thinking about a drink. And I was like, nope, I got to walk away. So since then, I have started my own business. And I really like it. I'm a little nervous about it, but I really like it. And then my husband retired at the same time. So he's now a retiree. And he's been like, I got to say that my husband is just the perfect person for me. I mean, he is just so supportive and we're able to talk. I know that Timothy, you had asked me a while back, you know, what makes your marriage work and what do you do differently? Because there's a lot of marriages that are struggling out there. And I think because he came from this environment that was just a constant argumentative between his mom and dad, constant, constant, constant. And mine was abuse, abuse, abuse. I mean, argumentative stuff is abusive too. But we decided when we first got together that we would never call each other names and we would not go to bed angry, and that we could always talk about things. We didn't have to yell or shout. And I have to say that I think there's only been maybe 4 or 5 occasions in our 42 years of marriage where we both yelled. But most of the time, if we had an issue, we talked about it. And that can be scary. I mean, it can be scary. And Lord knows that I go to my therapist with some of the stuff on how to handle it, because I'm not equipped. I mean, I'm not totally equipped on how great relationships work, because I just never had that in my purview. I have 2 boys and a daughter and 6 grandchildren. I think we have a pretty darn good relationship. I mean, I can talk to the kids about just about anything. I don't bring up a lot of the abuse issues because it's not really their business, but they know about it. One of the other things that I forgot to tell you about was that I was also, so 13, my friend died. And then at 15, I went to the church, the Catholic church, for help. And I was molested by a priest. Mm. And so that's really significant in that glass ceiling about a higher power in AA, because I just couldn't buy it. I could not buy that it was a man and that I must have really pissed him off. And so I've been on a journey with that. And I finally found a church where it's a female and male entity. So when they say the Lord's Prayer, they say our Father, our Mother, you know, that kind of thing. So it's more of a balance. It's not in the parental role, because neither one of my parents were really great, of course. And, you know, my mom is still alive. And I just recently made amends to her. I've been trying to get her to love me, and she can't. She's not capable of doing it. She's never been capable of doing it. And so I've confronted her a few times about, you know, leaving me in situations where she knew what was going to happen, and why did she do that? And she said, I don't know. I guess on some level I knew what was going to happen. I just didn't think about it. And a beer was more important to me, which is, you know, kind of what I guess I needed to hear that. But disregarding her behavior, disregarding what she hurt people, number one. And number two is that it's my side of the street, not hers. And so I was able to, she's kind of in and out of reality now. And so I asked her, do you know what day it is? Do you know your name? Do you know who I am? And so I could make sure that she was aware of it. And I just apologized to her for not being the daughter that she needed me to be. Cause I eliminated her from my life for about 7 or 8 years. but that's part of the program. I mean, it's part, when we finally get through our own slop and swamp and shame, we can finally get on an even road and then look on the other side of the street and say, hey, what did I do? And so it takes a long time for some people. And, you know, there's still a couple of people in my resentment list from day one that I've not been willing or able or capable or even going there in my thoughts. So it's going to take what it's going to take. And if I die with them on my conscience or on my plate, it hasn't been that I haven't been willing, because there's a point in time where I can talk about stuff and then it's done. I don't know if you get that. It's called the floating head syndrome or something like that, where it's self-protection and it just stops. And so I'm willing to deal with the stuff, but my heart says yes, but my head says no. If that makes any sense.
It does in my own way. The mother of little Timmy, the child that I killed driving under the influence, the first 8 years of my sobriety and speaking for MAD, if she would have came into my life and said, Timothy, kill yourself, I'd have probably did. Mm-hmm. She had that much power. And it took me some serious work to get to the point to where I could look in the mirror, 8 years of doing this daily thing called mirror therapy, because my sponsor said to do it. And, you know, I chose a female sponsor because my abuser was male and I didn't trust males. And even though I'm a male, it's like, you know, and I couldn't accept hugs from men as easily as I could women, because I had my guard down. And, but, you know, I had these wounded things going on in my consciousness, and I got to the point one day to where I looked in the mirror at, you know, every day I do what my sponsor said. She said, first thing, you don't have a cigarette, you don't have a cup of coffee, you don't even pee. You walk up to a mirror and you point at yourself, look yourself in the eyes, say your name out loud and say, Timothy, I love you. And you do that every day until you mean it. Well, Deb, it took me 8 years. And then one day I did that. I pointed at myself and I did exactly what she said. And I meant it. And I was shocked. I couldn't see the ex-convict. I couldn't see the baby killer in the same way that I did before. I couldn't see the racist. I couldn't see all these things that used to be wrong with me. And I'm not saying that all my problems just were instantly gone, you know better, you know, but I looked at myself and I just thought, I'm just seeing things here, but I thought I saw a white aura around my face, around my existence. I thought, how is this possible? This is a mirror. The mirrors can't show that, but that's what I saw, you know? And I loved myself and I forgave myself for if the mother of little Timmy would have came back after that and said, kill yourself, sorry, that person is dead. He doesn't exist anymore, you know? And I did kill myself. I died to selfishness in that one aspect of my life. And it was very difficult because I wanted to kill myself almost every time I would speak, you know? And it was one of the hardest things I ever did to not drive my car 100 miles an hour and crash into a bridge or a tree just to prove to you people how sorry I was for killing this child. And I never wanted to kill myself again for that reason. ever again. There's a lot of other reasons I wanted to kill myself, but not that one. So it's just, and I just, it's like you said that you just love that person as she is. Well, it's like, I just love the part of me that wants to commit suicide. I love you, man, you know, and I just don't judge it. It's just part of my character. It comes up and it passes. It comes up and it passes. And it's, you know, and I would have killed myself, Deb, if it weren't for step three, which for those of you that know what that is, you don't need the explanation, but step three is where we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand God. And my life wasn't mine to take. I had literally turned my will and life over the care of God, and I couldn't kill myself because it wasn't mine anymore. And I thought, oh, geez, you know, God, how about if you kill me? Mm-hmm. Just take me out of here. I'm so sick of this stuff, you know, and, you know, the dark night of the soul and all kinds of stuff. But so, yeah, I think I have some comprehension of that paradigm. And so the floor is yours again. Sorry, I do.
That's all right. I mean, I did go through a number of years with PTSD and wanting to kill myself and wanting to hurt myself. And I still, you know, sometimes I'm shocked with PTSD sometimes. I mean, it's not like it goes away. It lasts a lot less time and it gets a lot less severe, but it's still there and it can shake me and put me off my feet for a couple of days. But if I can remember that it's PTSD, then I can get reconnected in the head. Because when you get PTSD, you disengage from here and it's called, what do they call it? Like caveman mind or something like that, where you cannot physically think about what's next. You're just there. And so when I'm there, I've done a lot of work to reach out to people, and I have my trusted people who I can call and say anything to them, especially when I'm standing at the shore of shame, they throw me a rope. They say, no, you don't have to go in there. I understand. This is what I did. This is how I do it. And then I'm able to paint it outside of me. So a couple months ago, I woke up with nightmares, because I get the nightmares still. And all the things that the family members used to tell me, all negative stuff. And so I one of the things that I do is I do what's called urban sketching. You just paint what's in front of you. So I painted my hand and I wrote down all of the things that I was hearing in my mind that they had told me when I was younger. And then I just let them float up and I transformed them into words that were a lot more nourishing, like you're forgiven, you're loved, you're safe. I mean, that's my mantra. I'm loved. I'm loved. I'm loved. I am safe. I am safe. I am safe. Mm-hmm. And that has been my mantra for a long, long time, because there's points in time where I just get so afraid, and I'm afraid of everything, afraid of succeeding, afraid of losing, afraid of losing what I have, afraid of keeping what I have. I mean, all of these craziness things. And so then I can just go straight to my mantra and just know that I'm loved. And that I don't need to be afraid anymore. Anyway, I drew that picture and I was able to let go. I drew my hand. I drew those words. I drew those pictures flying up. And it gives me great peace. And so it's one of those things.
I have some artist friends that I think would love to hear this story too. So I'm going to.
Yeah. Well, the worst thing is I painted a bird, a dove over it, and then it looked like the dove was pooping in my hand. So I had to take the dove off. But that's what I do. And then I teach senior citizens how to paint. That's part of my job right now, is I get to go and teach them some of the art stuff. I teach them a little bit of technique, and they don't have to pay anything for it. I pay for it all. I teach them technique. And I teach them a little bit how to let go, and they're amazed at what they can do. I think it's just beautiful, because a lot of them have never been in a situation. They come from an abusive background, like my mom, maybe. And it's something that I can give them with no strings attached. So I love that part of, of what I'm doing right now. And I'm still going to meetings. I still help out where I can. I still sponsor when I'm asked. I'm a terrible sponsor though.
Yeah, I'm not the best sponsor either, but.
No, but, and I have a sponsor and, I pray every day. I try to meditate on a daily basis. My life is definitely different. So much different. And my grandkids are just amazing. All six of them. They're each so precious and so, talented. And they're so much smarter than I'll ever be. And they love me, you know, they love me for who I am, and I love them for who they are. So,
you know, I suppose you've done this in some, and you've even touched on it, but you've done this in some sort of way, but if you could advise your younger self, which is actually still alive today in some ways, if you could advise your younger self how to handle life.
I take her everywhere with me. Yeah. I take her everywhere with me.
There you go. See, I knew that.
I take her everywhere with me. And when I feel that big bang of fear, I'm like, oh, honey, it's okay. I got you now. You're going to be okay. You're okay. Mm. Things work out. You know, you don't have to live there anymore. Come on with me. Mm. Let's go do this. And sometimes she's the one painting. Sometimes she's the one writing. Sometimes she's the one just out. I love nature. I love gardening. I love being walking and looking at flowers and watching bees. I mean, I just take her with me wherever I go. So
nice.
I let her know that, and I kind of talk to her and think about her in a second person, but she was just so scared before. So scared that she wouldn't come with me at all. And now she comes with me happily. And there's different ages of me. I have this whole park filled with little Debbies, whether they're, you know, 1 or 2 years old up to 18 or 20 or even 41 years old. I mean, I just, you know, what is it that you're afraid of? I'm going to bring you here to this park. It's perfectly safe and you can do whatever you want to do. And I have different clothes on and it's just pretty amazing, actually.
You know, I met the angry spirit that used to plague me, if you will, and I think it was me probably, but whatever, you know. But I was doing a darkness retreat, and I was prayerful all the time during the darkness retreat, and I think it was like the second or the third day of the retreat, that I encountered the angry man, and he looked like me, but he was just full of rage, and he just like came at me, you know, and was just and you know what I did is I just loved him. Said, I love you, man, you need a hug, you know. And I gave him a hug, and he quit being mad. He just like, that's all he ever wanted was just to be loved, you know.
And I've done that too. I've embraced, you know, the negative emotions that we have. And one of the things that I have an eating disorder. Okay. So I painted this painting where I'm standing in front of a cupboard and you see my backside, right? And I'm looking at the cupboard going, what can I eat? What can I make myself feel better with? And down at the bottom of my legs are all these little kids. They're all little me's trying to get my attention. They're crying or laughing, but they're clinging on to my pant legs. And I'm just like totally oblivious. And that is what that the anger person or the fearful person or any one of those entities, if I stop and I recognize what's going on, because I don't want to. I mean, I don't want to pay attention. All of a sudden I can breathe into it again and go, I get it.
Do you meditate or journal?
Journaling is kind of dangerous for me just because my mind can go. Painting is my journaling. As far as meditating, walking is my meditation. I do, but I don't sit down on a pillow and go om like that, because being in my mind is like being in a dark alley, and that's not always good either. So I have to have something distracting. So what I'll do is and that's why I loved running so much. I could, you know, after about a mile or so, I could just get into the groove of it and pray and meditate and not have to think about anything. And so that's what I do with walking. I notice the things around me and listen to the birds. And sometimes I'll listen to music that I really feel safe with. And
yeah, I was just going to ask you if you did that, you know, do you have a favorite musician or song or series of songs? I know it's kind of hard to pin one down. But...
I actually have, there's a couple of them that I really like Brave from Sarah Bareilles. Oh gosh, what's her name? I can't think of the names right now. Miley Cyrus's The Climb, Rascal Flatts, Why, Mercy Me's The Hurt and the Healer. A lot of those songs. I actually enjoy Mercy Me, which some people, it's Christian music and some people don't like it, but they really speak to me about where I was, where I'm going and where I'm at now.
I had listened to Mercy Me and some other bands, but during the Dark Night of the Soul, and it's funny the things that God sends into our lives, you know. It's like there's a woman by the name of Janine, and I can't remember her last name, but I came across a CD in a garage sale. I was out with my Al-Anon sponsor, and we used to go garage sailing, and it would get my mind off of some of the, you know, some of the stuff I was going through at the time. And it was just like that. Yeah. And the CD was exactly what I needed to hear at the time. You know, it's like God sent me right to the right place to get the, you know, it was like waiting on me. And she and I became acquaintances years later. And I had the hardest time finding her. But then I came into her sphere right at the time when she needed it the most. So it's funny how years later, like God used her music to help me. And then God used me, who was helped by her, to turn around and echo back to her what she gave me back in those days. And, you know, and there was one day, Deb, that my sponsor and I were out garage sailing, and we were in a cul-de-sac. And I was so deep in angst, not bitterness or resentment, just pain, you know, because all the parts that weren't real were getting burned off of me, you know. And the real me had nerves that had grown into the not real me. And the not real me was getting burned off, but the nerves felt it. So I don't know how else to describe it, but I was in so much pain, and there was this little almost rectangular, weird looking grassy knoll between, you know, the cul-de-sac there. And I was standing on that, and my sponsor was standing on the cul-de-sac. And it was an overcast day. It was just totally cloud overcast, gray. And it's like, just like my mood, you know, it's like, and I just cried out to God, and I didn't say anything out loud. You know, I just said, God, please help, or something. I don't even know what the prayer was. Just help me, you know? And suddenly it's just like, I was standing. It's like this little hole opened in the clouds. And I was standing in a beam of sunlight, and it wasn't anywhere else. It was right on me. And I felt God's love just shining down in that light, you know, and my sponsor's mouth just like dropped open and was just staring at me, you know, and I kind of feel, it sounds like I'm pumping sunshine, but I'm not. You know, I feel like this is kind of how this works in life. And this is like a role that you've played in my life. And anytime I'm in contact with you and you share things, I feel like that's happening all over again. You know, it's like this divine synchronicity, common stuff. What I don't know, have the right words for it, but it just animates gratitude within me, and I feel closer to God. Just, you know, so I'm quite grateful for the role that you've played in my life. And you know, do you think gratitude is important?
Oh my gosh. Gratitude is the band-aid for everything. I mean, it is the true healing solution for everything. I mean, when I can be in the crappiest moods, and my sponsor has always said, all right, start making a list of gratitude. And she said, if you're not grateful by 20, then add 20 more, and then add 20 more. And this was an early sobriety. And I would have 100 reasons to be grateful. Things like, I thank you, God, for not giving me pink eye, you know, stupid stuff like that. But by the end of it, I was grateful. Here's another one that evokes gratitude. So I was just about 6 months sober, and I was just really, really crabby and angry. I'm tired. Tom isn't home yet. And I talked to my sponsor, and she said, why don't you go bake some cookies with love? And I said, I don't have stuff for cookies. And I don't have stuff. I don't have this for cookies or anything. And so she goes, so bake a cake. And she said, when you do it, muster up as much love as you can and put it into that recipe. And so by the time I even had the flour and eggs and stuff like that dumped in, I already had a smile on my face. I mean, so, and then the other things that somebody had said, I don't know if it wasn't her, but she said that the hardest thing is to scrub your own bathtub. And we can go help all the people that we want, but to go home and scrub your own bathtub is really a chore. So go do it, and do it with a smile on your face. And so that's, you know, truly, because we get outside ourselves, we get outside of that crazy thinking, and we do things that are helpful to other people. I mean, whenever I find myself wanting to help another human being, my selfishness disappears. It completely eliminates and is gone. So I highly recommend it.
Me too.
100 yeah, things. Write down 100 things that you're grateful for.
Yeah. There's so many things that'll make us laugh or smile. And sometimes we got to dig a little bit. Just the slightest little effort of willingness can go so far, you know? Yeah. And, you know, someone asked me, or maybe I asked myself, what my superpower was once. And I do ask this of people in Sober Wise Guy, you know, and, you know what? I'll ask you this a second. I'll tell you this, but I thought my superpower is not committing suicide, you know? And, you know, it's just like, there's always something that it's like, God is my superpower, really. So I'm not taking credit or anything. But yet I was willing, you know, and there's free will that no one can give you and no one can take away. And no matter what anyone has done to me, how I feel about it today is up to me. And I might have PTSD about some stuff, you know, and I don't think that'll ever go. I have reactions from doing prison times that people have no comprehension of. Normal things that you take for granted, I'll look at that, and there's a part of me that's like freaking out, you know, and you can't see it because I'm, you know, it's not illegal to be crazy. It's only illegal to act crazy. And I learned to not act out on these things. But you know, I'm still here. So that's my superpower, if you will. So what's your superpower if there is one?
I think I have a couple. One is perseverance. One is resilience. One is kindness. And then I think my art.
Your art gives you energy and joy.
Oh yeah. It's great joy. Yep. Even if I know what these pictures mean. You guys don't know what they mean, but I know what they mean, but I still am very attached to them. I couldn't give them away. So I couldn't sell them because of what they mean to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
What, you know, there's probably maybe, who knows, someone who's listening that doesn't know if they want to be sober, or they're struggling and they can't stay sober or something. You know, is there some guiding principle that would help maybe listeners stay sober or get sober, or why bother, you know, that whole thing?
Well, my daughter-in-law, she said this was just a couple of years ago, she goes, man, I just can't go imagine going through life without drinking. And I said, oh, really? I said, there are a lot less, there are a lot of other things that are worse than not drinking. And for me as an alcoholic, drinking would be deadly. I mean, I drank to forget and to get out, and but it didn't work. It did not work. And so sobriety is a way out of not working. I mean, sobriety is like, it's like fresh grass in the summertime. It's like hyacinth in the spring. It's hope. And that's what I came back with from my very first AA meeting, was hope. It was the first time I ever had hope in all my life. And so I have to say that there is hope for each and every one person who says they can't get sober. They can. And it's really just one minute. I started out at 10 minutes at a time. I was like, I'm just going to stay sober for 10 minutes, just for 10 minutes. And within that 10 minutes, I would add another 10 minutes and then another 10 minutes. And I remember getting to 24 hours. I was like, wow, I was amazed. I hadn't thought about a drink all day. And it's removed from us. I mean, that's the miracle of the program, is that it is the thought and the idea of drinking is removed from us. And that's what I would say, is that we're not stuck jonesing for a drink or a cigarette or a dube or whatever for all of our lives. It's removed from us, and other things are put in placement, as long as we stay in fit spiritual condition. Mm-hmm. And we just have to do a few simple things. And that's the 12 steps, really. I mean, and wow, I get that for that little bit of work. I'm okay with that, because I put an awful lot of work into drinking. Mm-hmm. I put an awful lot into convincing myself that I needed to drink and then I was going to have a drink. There's hope.
Mm-hmm.
There's hope, hope, hope. But we can't do it alone.
You know, the 12 steps to some people probably sounds like a lot, but the truth is that we give so little and we get so much back in comparison. It's just like the smallest amount of willingness just opens that door, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like there's a light that shines in darkness through willingness, and the darkness might not understand it. Someone's life might not feel like it makes sense to them. And I remember I stole my first big book in prison, you know, because I didn't want anyone to know I was going to read it, you know. And same with a Bible, by the way. I stole a Bible from the prison library, the prison chapel library. And it's like, I didn't want, my ego was just kind of running the show, but there was some part of me, you know?
Yeah, but that's denial, right? I don't want anybody to know, you know?
Yeah.
I'm so ashamed. I mean, shame. If you ever listen to Brené Brown is amazing, but shame is the number one killer. And it's the most useless, absolute useless emotion. There's nothing good about it. And so when we're at that shore of shame and we throw that vine out to the people who know us, we're never alone. I mean, we're just never alone, whether we're in a prison cell or being abused in our own home. We don't have to go back there anymore. We don't. And there's help available.
Yeah, there was. It took an actual miracle for me to forgive my sexual abuser, and You know, when I found out he wanted to make amends, I had been in sobriety some while, and I don't know how long. Maybe it was around that 8-year mark that I already talked about, but you know, maybe 9 or 10. But I just about panicked when I heard that, and I called my sponsor, and I thought she was going to say, "Oh, you don't have to meet him if you don't want to," you know. And it's like, I didn't know if I was going to kill him or hurt him or what. I had no clue. All I knew is I had these things going on in my head to where I think about him and I just imagine beating him with a 2x4. That's how spiritual I was, you know. And so when I called her, and I was just totally relaxed that she was going to say, you don't have to, you know, she said, "Well, you got to meet him." What? You know, she said, you know, when someone wants to get well, we can't be an obstacle. We got to let them. Mm-hmm. We got it. We can't be an obstacle. You have mm-hmm. to meet with them. And I said, "But I don't know if I'm going to want to hurt him or kill him." He says, "You're not going to hurt him. You're not going to kill him. I'll go with you if you want me to," you know? And so I agreed to it. She's my sponsor, and you just say yes, you know. And oh my God, it was so hard. I was so afraid. And I went to my home group in AA, and I told them what I was planning, and I was asking everyone I knew in recovery for prayer, emailing anyone that would hear the prayer request, calling, you name it, you know. And I had all these people praying for me. And the day came when we were going to meet, and we went to a public place because my sponsor said, "We're going to be in a public place, so you guys behave," you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a part of me that believed that if someone was to compromise, they had no idea how compromisable I was. You know, somebody wanted to rape me, they could have did it, and they just didn't know, you know. And I felt like there was that little child that felt like they had no power. You know, so I was so terrified, and I was really more scared of me than anyone else, I guess. But, you know, and I didn't want to be that vulnerable. So, but any case, so my sponsor and I are sitting in front of this restaurant in a strip mall, and I was doing like a Jew at the Wailing Wall. I was rocking back and forth, you know, and I was praying mm-hmm. to God, "Please help me, please help me, please help me," you know. And she kept saying, "Is that him?" You know, the door would open in a little mall area, and my adrenaline would just surge through my body, and look up, and it's not him. And she kept doing that, you know, "Is that him? Is that him?" And it's just like, I wanted to tell her to shut the F up, you know, mm-hmm. You know, cause that toxin of adrenaline would surge through my body, and I just feel sick. And then finally she said, "Is that him?" And as I started to look up, I felt something was different, you know, and this is where the miracle happened. And I saw these colors coming down out of the sky at like a 45 degree angle. And it was like every color of the rainbow and more. There was more colors there than you could possibly imagine, more colors that are visible in the spectrum to the human eye. And as I looked up at him, these little droplets of water, which are actually like fire water, all went into my chest, and it just boom, all just rushed into my chest. And as soon as I laid eyes on him, the power from heaven of love came into my heart, and I loved him that very instant. And I was not physically, emotionally, spiritually capable of doing that for myself. And you know, God had to do that for me. I couldn't do it, you know. And and I actually loved him from that point forward, and I didn't want to kill him anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't all happy and stuff, but you know, about him, but it was a whole different world. And I literally had a dream where I saw these colors coming down from the sky, splashing into a wall that said, "The Lord is coming." And, you know, and I had that dream when I was 19 years old, and it was the same colors, it was the same droplets of colors, you know. So we have miracles. And I know people are going, if I don't have to believe in God, I'm not going to believe in God to do all this stuff. You know, just the slightest willingness, just ask the question. And, you know, it's like if you ask God to help and if there's no answer, then you're off the hook, you know. But actually,
I was so afraid of God when I first came into the meetings. Every time I saw the word God, I turned it to dog. And that helped me stay in my chair without leaving. And so whatever you, and then they said, well, your higher power is anything that you want it to be, whatever is going to make you feel comfortable with. And so dog was it.
Mm-hmm.
Dog.
That was really important, Deb, for me too, in early recovery. Nobody said you have to have, you know, you could have your own conception of your higher power, whatever that is, you know, and I was so crazy. I needed that. You know?
Yeah, I was too. I mean, I had dog, and then my second one was I could visualize a pitcher, like a softball pitcher, and I was the batter. And sometimes I got to hit a home run and other times I just got out, you know, but, and then next it was a big rock, one big cold rock that I could not move or manipulate. And then pretty soon it transformed. It's transformed itself so many different times, but those are the three that I remember. And it's God as you understand God. And it, I took him off of there because I don't believe that God is just a male entity. And I think I said that earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
well, good. It needs to be said more than once. It's
And then sometimes it's just through other people. I can see that higher power through. And I see it in their eyes, you know. I can feel it in their hug or whatever. I mean, so
that's a lifesaver, man.
Yeah.
So you said something about Brene Brown, but what quote do you like of hers or anybody's that's been very useful to you in your life? We're getting close to wrapping it up here, by the way, just so you know. Do you have any favorite quotes? I can give you one of mine while you're thinking.
Go ahead.
You know, do you remember Ernie Larson by?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yep, I met him. Yep, I came in for ACA with Ernie Larson. Yep.
I was in ACA too. But he said, pain becomes power when you hold it up to grace. You know, and he was so fond of saying things like that, you know, and he meant it. He wasn't just BSing. He was
he was a good guy.
He was just, he's just full of love, you know.
Yeah. I think the thing that has actually helped me the most, I can't even say the most, the AA slogans have helped me tremendously, and the Serenity Prayer, of course. And then I am safe, I am safe, I am safe, I am loved, I am loved, I am loved.
I love that. Yeah, that fed me when you said that.
Yeah.
What?
I mean, it's taken me so many years to know that I'm loved. It's just taken a long, long time.
Yeah, I say go where the love is, and if you don't, you know, if you don't find any, bring some. You know.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought this woman here was capable of so much love and having such a great family and friends and. Environment and have such a talent of painting, or I don't even know if it would be a talent, but have such a passion with painting. I just would have never guessed it. I would have never, ever guessed it. And I almost killed myself at 19. It was really close, and I would have missed out on all of this.
And so would we have.
Yeah.
Not
so there are two moments in that are specifically like on the other realm of things. So that one, I was 19 years old, and I had just broken up with an abusive boyfriend. This was before I met my husband, and it was right before Christmas, and he had driven all the way down to see me, and I was in another state, and I threw his ring at him. I didn't want to, he was going to propose to me. And I said, no. He was already a blackout drinker, and I didn't want any part of that. And I felt so terrible about it. And There was a gun in the closet. My brother had a gun. And so I went to go get it. And I heard a voice, and the voice said, "Don't let the bastards win." I was like, "Whoa, wait, who was that? Who's that?" And I heard it again. It said, "Don't let the bastards win." And so I decided, okay, I won't do that. And I went and called my grandma. And my grandma, she couldn't do a whole lot to keep me safe, but she was my my go-to. And she said, "Debbie, don't you know that you are loved and allowed to be happy in your life?" And I had never heard that. I had never, ever heard that. So that was a profound happening. And then the next one occurred, well, when I met Tom and saw the aura. And then the next one after that was when I sobered up. The first night I went to a meeting, and I came home and I went to bed, and in my mind's eye, this was real. The floor of my bedroom opened up, and up came the devil. And the devil said, "Just get down here because you're not going to make it." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're not going to make it. You're not going to make it in sobriety." And I said, "I am going to make it." And I was being pulled out of bed, and I popped back up, and I was sitting straight up, and the hole disappeared. And from that moment on, I said, I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to be sober. And so it wasn't like it could be analyzed that you've made a decision on your psyche and your unconscious and blah, blah, blah. But that disappearing of the hole, it was like drinking is no longer an option for you. And so that's kind of how I've dealt with it is it's not that I didn't crave drinking. It was that, nope, that's not for me. And I'm going to go do something else.
There's so many synchronicities between your life and mine and people I've met. Just yesterday, there was a guy who's really struggling, and he went to the ER, and I told him, day before yesterday, I said, "Don't let the bastards grind you down." Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah. And then there's
I always consider you a brother from another mother. So, that's Timothy, my brother
from another. What a privilege. Yeah. And there is a friend in Mad who sobered up, and she had a battle with the devil too, where I really think she said the floor opened up, and then some stuff came out of the floor, and she went into a battle with these spirits. Yeah. And then the angels came to help her too, and she was surrounded by angels, and nobody could touch her. You know, but it was I think she said that there was a hole in the floor, and that's where they came up out of. I really think maybe my memory's wrong, but I think that's what she said. So it's,
I suppose that's where it would come, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that we are all protected in a sense of, I like to believe that I'm buffered, and that I've had some really hard things happen to me. And, like my relationship with my husband, I think is just God's way of saying, "I'm sorry you went through that." Here's a great guy, you know? And
there are some out there.
He's really one of them. He's a keeper. Mm-hmm. And I always say he's the better half of our relationship, you know? He just smiles.
I get it.
So anyway.
Well, my friend, I love you. I appreciate you. I'm glad you're doing your art, and I'm glad God's using your story to help people to this day. And, you know, I don't know how much longer we're going to be around on this whole planet of ours, or school, whatever you want to call it. But, God bless you and Tom and your 6 grandchildren and your art, just everything.
Thank you.
God bless
you too.
Yes. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for tuning in to another episode of Sober Wise Guy on The Incomplete Skeptic. And remember, you have a voice. Use it for love. If you don't tell at least 3 people a day that you love them, you've probably wasted a day of your life. Don't do that. Don't waste your life. Tell someone you love them. Peace out.